You know, lately, blessings have been on my mind, and I'm not sure exactly, you know, how far back that I could identify that. Just been more cognizant of blessings and thinking more about blessings. And, you know, we've just come through the Passover, the night to be much observed, the days of unleavened bread, and we see, you know, the stupendous blessings that God has made available to all of us and to all mankind, really. And we think about those events and what the events historically picture. You know, we think about the deliverance of the nation of Israel from the most powerful nation in the world at that time in Egypt, and the stupendous deliverance that was for basically a people enslaved to be miraculously blessed with, you know, with freedom, and freedom from sin in the personification of Egypt at that time. We think about the deliverance that we can experience and have experienced, those of us who have been baptized and have had all of our sins washed away by the tremendous blessing that is the sacrifice of Jesus Christ for all sins, for all mankind, for all time. And we think about, as was mentioned in the sermonette, the patience of Jesus Christ, who bore our sins, you know, in his own body and endured the crucifixion and all of the shame, despised the shame, as Hebrews 12:2 says, you know, and that the torture that he went through and the humiliation that always preceded Roman crucifixion. You know, and he did that willingly and he did that patiently. You know, we think about, you know, miraculous healings that we may have observed or read about or personally experienced. You know, we look back in the pages of the Bible and we see, you know, tremendous deliverance in the form of resurrection of the dead that has taken place at different times and been recorded for us to read. You know, we read about a deliverance of the nation of Israel where that, as it says in the 19th chapter of 2 Kings, that the angel of the Lord killed 185,000 Syrian soldiers in one night and thereby delivered Israel from being conquered by, you know, that huge and powerful, you know, Syrian army. You know, these are monumental blessings, and we could go on and on listing, you know, one tremendous blessing after the other. But what's been on my mind lately is what I would like to call small blessings, small blessings. And this afternoon, I'd like to take a look at that subject of small blessings. Normally, I don't do a title, but on this one, my title is Looking for Small Blessings, Looking for Small Blessings. At this point, I'm going to issue a disclaimer because I think that's necessary here. By no means do I intend to denigrate or to make light of any of the blessings that God provides for us. By no means do I intend to, you know, to look down upon that. That's not my place or my point. I'd like to look at the blessings from God, not as those tremendously expansive ones that, you know, that I've mentioned, but to look at the blessings that we may experience even on a day-to-day basis as an expression of the special love that God has for his creation, for us as, you know, his sons and daughters, as spiritual, you know, embryos, so to speak, you know, potential sons and daughters in the family of God, and to look at the special kindness and the tenderness that God makes available to us in small blessings. There's three observations I'd like to make about small blessings before we get into going through some of those, and that is, we're faced with a challenge with small blessings at times when we look at something that happens to us and we think, now, was that just time and chance, or was that a small blessing from God? And by no means, you know, do I have the capability to, you know, in every case to say, well, it was one or the other. But sometimes we'll see something happen or I'll experience something and I'm thinking, you know, that was just a little bit too coincidental to think that God wasn't involved in that. And there's other times when you think, well, maybe it was just time and chance, so I'm not sure. So at times, I think when we look at, when we examine the subject of small blessings in our lives, and I'm going to use some personal examples, hopefully that will foster some review on your part in the things that you experience and have experienced on a day-to-day basis, and to see if, and I would fully expect to hear that there will be a significant number of events in your life that you can look back at and say, you know, that was a small blessing from God. And secondly, sometimes in the middle of other trials or inconveniences, there are small blessings. And we think that almost seems counterintuitive, but I think we'll read of in the Bible of some cases where that is true. And I have, you know, one personal experience where that was certainly true in my case. In the middle of a trial, there's small blessings from God that took place, in some of these trials. And lastly, God is not our genie. We do not have that relationship with God where that just any old thing, any old time, we can ask and bang, you know, we receive that. So God is not our genie, but he has the capacity and the capability and his wisdom to do things for us either on a grand scale or on a very small scale. Before we get into the two points that I'd like to, or two areas that I'd like to explore this afternoon, let's take a look at this one point. What is God's disposition toward us? How is he disposed toward us? How does he look at us? How does he work with us? And if you want to, please turn to Matthew 6, and we'll read verse 8, or I'll just read it to you for the sake of time. Matthew 6 and verse 8. In thinking about this, one thing that struck me about looking at this verse at this time is the placement of the verse. First, we'll read it, and then I'll make a comment about the placement. Matthew 6, verse 8. Therefore, do not be like them, for your Father knows the things you have need of before you ask him. God is so involved with us that he intimately understands what our personal situations are. He knows what we need. He knows the needs that we have before it even comes to our mind that maybe I ought to get down on my knees and petition God for help in this or that area or this or that problem. But our Father knows the things that we have need of before we ask. Now, if we look at verse 8, we'll notice that, you know, if you have a Bible that has, different headings and things like that, this is a section that in my Bible is entitled the Model Prayer. So right here is inset, you know, between the description of, you know, the Jesus Christ's words about don't pray like the hypocrites, and, you know, there's a description of, you know, what they're doing and how they're going about this, and, you know, just the, you know, the unpleasant example that is. And then there's that verse 8 that's inset. Your Father knows what you have need of before you ask him, and then the next series of verses is the model prayer. And I find that really interesting, that an instruction and guidance on here's how not to pray and here's how to pray, that right in between those we have the verse that says your Father knows what you have need of before you ask. So that's how God is disposed toward us. Now what I'd like to do is read two companion passages, one in Matthew 7 and the other in Luke 11, that talks a little bit more about this. Matthew 7, let's begin in verse 7. Matthew 7, beginning in verse 7. Matthew 7, verse 7. Ask and it will be given to you. Seek and you'll find. Knock and it will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, he who seeks finds, and to him who knocks it will be opened. Verse 9. Or what man is there among you, if he asks his son for bread, will give him a stone? What a cruel joke, you know, and I think, is that literally just a big rock that is pictured here, or is it something that would appear like food that a child might actually take into their mouth thinking that this is actually food and it's a stone? You know, I don't know. I don't know that there's any way to determine that, but the contrast is very stark. You know, is a person so hard-hearted, is a man so hard-hearted, or a father so hard-hearted that he's going to give his son, you know, a rock when he's asking for something to eat? And then he continues, or if he asks for a fish, will he give him a serpent? Will he give him a snake? And then verse 11, if you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father, who is in heaven, give good things to those who ask him? again, how is God disposed toward us? And the contrast there, I think, is really remarkable. It's stark that uses a physical example and then says God is way beyond that in how he deals with us and how he accommodates us. You know, how much more will your Father, you know, who is in heaven, give good thanks, you know, to those that ask him? And again, he knows what we need before we ask. Now then, let's turn over to the 11th chapter of Luke. There's a slightly different way that this is recorded for us, and I think it's worth taking the time to read to augment what has already been said in Matthew 6, 8, and in these verses in Matthew 7. Luke 11, beginning at verse 9. Luke 11, 9. So I say to you, ask and it will be given to you, seek and you will find, knock and it will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, he who seeks finds, and to him who knocks it will be opened. Verse 11, if a son asks for bread from any father among you, will he give him a stone? Or if he asks for a fish, will he give him a serpent instead of a fish? And then Luke adds this, or if he asks for an egg, will he offer him a scorpion? Will he give him a poisonous bug? And then verse 13, if you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your heavenly Father give the Holy Spirit to ask them, to those who ask him? You know, we're reminded of this, and it adds some context here to what Matthew recorded, and also points us forward to Pentecost, which we will keep the day of Pentecost here shortly, the Feast of Pentecost. We read a number of passages in the Gospel of John at the Passover service here. I just want to pick out one of them, and I'll read it to you for the sake of time. But they all have some different aspects, or there are several that have some different aspects about, you know, asking God and that what God will do, how he will process that request. But in John 16:23, it says this, and in that day you will ask me, that is Jesus Christ, nothing. Most assuredly, I say to you, whatever you ask the Father in my name, he will give you. And we see a change in roles there in terms of the interaction with the disciples that were to become apostles, and you know how and to whom they would pray going forward and to whom they would make their requests. I'd like to go into this section, or these two sections of looking for small blessings, and in this manner to look at small blessings for which there were just small consequences, small blessings with small consequences, and in another case, and this one's hard for me to really determine, that it's small blessings that had large consequences, or potentially large consequences. I can't really defend that. If you'd say, well, why don't you count that as a large blessing? You know, I'd say, you know, it kind of depends on the situation. But let's take a look at some personal examples of small blessings with small consequences. We live in a long Highway 80 on the north side, about a quarter of a mile north of Highway 80. There is one electrical line that goes from the substation in Big Sandy, and it kind of goes back and forth over or across Highway 80 through a number of wooded areas, and it goes on a little bit closer to Gladewater from where we live. Anytime we have significant storms, it's not uncommon for tree limbs or trees to come down on those lines, short them out or knock them down or whatever. So we experience power outages, a lot of times with the storms that come through. We've had quite a number of storms, you know, this spring. And here's what happened to me on this one. Sometime during the night, I looked over and the clock is blank. So I'm thinking, oh, brother, you know, the clock never goes blank unless there's a power problem. So I thought, I'm not inclined to get up at 2:30 or 3 o'clock or whatever it was and, you know, start working on getting the generator set up and everything. And I have to let you know this, I have a love-hate with relationship with my generator. You know, I love it when it works, but I hate fooling with it, you know. And those of you that have electrical, talent or contracting talent would laugh at some of my woes with the generator, but that's just my problem with that generator. So I get up and, you know, got a couple of chores to do to take care of Kate's goats and, you know, get our dog taken care of. And so I'm thinking, you know, I'm going to have to go out into the garage and move a bunch of stuff out of the way so I can get at the generator. And then I'm going to have to wheel it around to the side of the house where that I've, you know, got the, you know, the location to hook it up, you know, and that's going to take a while. It's going to be a messy job, and then, you know, no telling how long I'll have to run it. I'll have to cool it down, put everything back, you know. So I'm looking at, you know, hour probably minimum to get it set up, running, and then clean up, go to work, or whatever. So I'm feeling a little woe is me and kind of a little bit aggravated about that, and especially starting my day without being adequately caffeinated, you know, because I don't have electricity, so things are not going well. So finally, after I get my few little chores taken care of, you know, I come back into the house and think, okay, got to go get my outside work clothes on, you know, get it done. So I walk into the den, and I notice, wow, the lamp's on. The lamp's on. And I think, was that time and chance, or was that just a small blessing? Because then I didn't have to fool with the generator. And I thought, wow, I'm 3 minutes from being, you know, from the coffee maker running. But, you know, I looked at that and I thought, that timing was just a little too good to be true for me. And again, maybe it was time and chance, but it was a small blessing for me. I didn't have to fool with that thing. And peace and tranquility and electrical, you know, electricity returned, you know, and I was thankful for that. You know, small blessing with small consequences. But the more I look, the more I see little things like that that I think, wow. Was that time and chance, or was that not time and chance? Was that something where God just chose to do me a very convenient small favor? And I'd ask you in your experience, your day-to-day experiences, if, you know, as you look around and you, you know, go through the daily experiences of life, if you don't, you know, encounter some of those same small blessings, and that we can't all, you know, come to a greater appreciation of the detailed kindness and tenderness that God the Father and Jesus Christ are, and that they extend to us as, you know, as his servants. Another small blessing with small consequences, and Rod Gerke would laugh at me for this, but we had a family dinner that we had planned for the last weekend of spring break. So Kay was going to meet us, and Dee was already in Tyler, and I was going to make my way to Tyler, and the restaurant was on the south side of Tyler, and we were going to meet there at a specific time and have dinner on a Friday night together. Get to the loop on the north side, and my car warning system, you know, sends me an alert, and it says, your tire pressure on the left rear tire is at 17 pounds. I'm thinking, faulty sensor, hopefully. Faulty sensor. Let's hope for a faulty sensor. So I go on through the, you know, the loop, and I'm heading on over to, you know, try to intersect Broadway and then go on down. And so I see my tire pressure continuing to drop. So I'm thinking, boy, I hope I don't have to stop somewhere in the middle of Tyler and change this tire in the dark. You know, and it's one thing if you're somebody like Rod that works with machinery on a day-to-day basis and you know all of the tricks, you do this regularly, you're mechanically inclined, which I'm not. And it's another thing to be in the situation that many of the rest of us are, that you think, now, when's the last time I changed a tire? Been a long time. So I'm thinking, well, maybe I could make it to the restaurant. You know, I was really looking forward to the dinner, and I thought, you know, I don't want to have to stop and change this thing, and then, you know, it'll take me at least a half an hour to do that, and then get on down there, I'm going to be messy and sweaty and everything. So I'm watching my tire pressure just slowly, you know, erode, and I'm thinking, you know, I'm getting closer and closer. Well, I made it, you know, and I pulled into the restaurant. And lo and behold, you know, it's a concrete parking lot. So I'm thinking, wow, that sure beats having to change this tire in the dark on the side of the road in the grass, you know, off the shoulder for safety's sake. So I find conveniently three parking places down from the light pole with a, you know, huge industrial or commercial, you know, parking lot light. There's an open spot, so I've got a nice, flat, hard surface, and I've got plenty of light, so I'm not going to have to put the mag light in my mouth while I'm, you know, managing or trying to move the tire and the wrench and all of that other stuff and try to keep from getting hurt at the same time. So went on in, and we had a nice dinner, and I watched my tire just slowly collapse, and we had a seat on that side of the restaurant. So I thought, finally, you know, I need to get out there and get that thing changed. So I went out there, started working on it, and I had two or three different people or two or three different guys that came up and said, well, you need any help with that tire? And so, no, I think I got this one, you know. So things were going along, you know, really well. And Kate came out and she was helping. A couple of times, you know, people said, well, let me roll this one out of the way. And, you know, just real helpful. So, you know, I thought about that later and I thought, now, if I could just change some of the circumstances, that could have happened and I could have been out on 271 in the dark, in the grass, trying to manage changing this tire safely. But I was blessed with, I had plenty of light, I had plenty of help, I had a nice hard flat surface, and even with my limited mechanical ability, you know, everything went really well. So I looked at that and I think, was that time and chance? Or was there something more than that? But I certainly took it as it was a small blessing. And I was thankful that, you know, we had a nice dinner and that we you know, we weren't, you know, terribly affected by, you know, by that flat. Another event that was in my life that was a small blessing that for me had, you know, small consequences, but my mother passed away on the 16th of April. That was 3 days before the Passover. And so in the middle of, you know, the trial of, you know, of her death and, you know, the combination of the relief at, you know, her anxiety and her battle with Alzheimer's or an Alzheimer's-like condition, that was over and there's relief in that. You know, there's certainly the loss that we all experience with the death of a parent. But I started thinking about, even in that, the small blessing of the timing of her death. I thought, wow, that could have been on Passover Day. So how would I have felt? You know, could I have kept the Passover then? Or would I have needed to have considered maybe taking the second Passover? You know, would I have been able to have focused appropriately and adequately on the observance of the Passover or not? So I thought about that. You know, I think, was it just time and chance or not? But for me, it was a small blessing. And it had some very desirable consequences, you know, in that regard with respect to the timing of her death. Now let's turn, and I'd like to read a biblical example of the small blessing with small consequences. Let's take a look at the second chapter of John and read the first 10 verses in the first or the second chapter of John. John 2, verse 1. On the third day there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Now both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding. When they ran out of wine, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." Now certain obscure manuscripts will add to this, that this parenthetical thought that the wedding planner was terminated on the spot. No, that's not the case, but can you imagine that? You know, you've got that had to be a sizable wedding because we've already listed 14 people. You know, so that, and we're not even into the, you know, to the listing of the size of that crowd, but they ran out of wine. And you think for something that, you know, a special event like this, a special case, and then there's some kind of a mistake or a foul up and we're out of wine. And the mother of Jesus said, you know, they have no wine. And Jesus says to her, "Woman, what does your concern have to do with me? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Whatever he says to you, do it." That is a remarkable statement right there. I mean, we don't have the benefit of more information about the looks, the dialogue between Jesus Christ and his mother, but we see the wisdom that she exhibits there, that she obviously believed he could do something about it. I think that's implicit with her statement when she says to the servants, "Whatever he tells you, do it." And then she leaves it to Jesus Christ to decide what he's going to do. And then continuing in verse 6, "Now there were set there 6 water pots of stone, according to the manner of purification of the Jews, containing 20 or 30 gallons apiece." 20 or 30 gallons apiece. So we're looking at 120 to 180 gallons of water. And we're told specifically, in the next verse, Jesus said to them, fill the water pots with water, and they filled them to the brim. So we're not talking about 4 inches in the bottom of the container. You know, we're talking about the size of these containers, 20 or 30 gallons apiece, 6 of them full to the brim. Then in verse 8, and he, that is Jesus, said to them, draw some out now and take it to the master of the feast. And they took it. When the master of the feast, verse 9, had tasted the water that was made wine and did not know where it came from, but the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom. And he said to him, every man at the beginning sets out the good wine. When the guests have well drunk, then the inferior. You've kept the good wine until now. You were serving Mondavi Woodbridge in the beginning, and you pulled out the Mondavi Special Reserve. What's going on here? You know, some of you that are wine connoisseurs would know, you know, a whole lot more expensive wines or better wines than those. But that's a simple little comparison. But what a remarkable thing that was a pretty sizable wedding for, you know, there to be the need for 120 to 180 gallons of wine. You know, Jesus Christ could have said, well, to the wedding planner about to be unemployed, you better run down to the corner package store and pick up a little bit. But none of that was there. And a small blessing, I'm sure that the bride and the groom and the wedding planner were very grateful for that, the way that turned out. But imagine that Jesus Christ is God in the flesh that took the time, had the care for, you know, some physical situation like this to intercede in basically an unobserved manner. Only the servants really saw it take place. And to see that all of a sudden there is some terrific wine that is available, and you know, the wedding party proceeded. A small blessing with some small consequences. Now I'd like to look at a couple of personal examples of small blessings with big consequences. As the custom was, or in our family with my wife and her two sisters and their mother, we would rotate Thanksgiving in one of those four locations. And this took place sometime probably in the latter 1990s, but it was Dee's turn to host, and we had Thanksgiving in our place. And you know, typically, if it was our place, we'd have some activities on Friday or whatever, maybe some different things. But in this particular year, Dee and both of her sisters and their mother went to Tyler, and they were going to do some shopping and looking around or whatever. They're on their way back to the house after, you know, they'd spent, you know, part of the afternoon there in Tyler. And all of a sudden, the oldest sister, Judy Servideo, just said, you know, I really like a cup of coffee. You know, can we go back to Starbucks? You know, we passed one, you know, wherever. Can we go back and get a cup of coffee? I'd really like a cup of coffee. And I remember Dee saying, you know, she's driving along and thinking, oh, brother. I mean, can't she wait until we get home? And we're 30 minutes from the house, you know. But she didn't say anything, and she did the, you know, U-turn and went back, and they got Judy her cup of coffee, and then they got back on the loop, and they started back around toward, you know, toward 271. And they came up to one of the intersections, and they see a lot of emergency vehicles. There's been a terrible automobile crash. And we read later that there were two people that were killed in that automobile accident. Their other sister made the comment, said, wow, that happened about the time that we would have been going through that intersection. So was it time and chance, or was that a small blessing from God? Because the way that it worked out, they weren't in that intersection or near that intersection when that terrible crash took place. So some of those are hard to tell, but you know, it was a sobering experience for the four of them to, you know, drive through that intersection and see, you know, see what had taken place and to realize how close they were to that. Was it a small blessing, or was it a time and chance incident? I had an experience the last day of duck season in 1998, I believe. A friend of mine and I, with several other guys that enjoyed duck hunting, had a lease down on the Sabine River bottom. Last day of duck season, it's one of those, you know, bluebird kind of days, not a cloud in the sky. It's warmer than what you'd like. because as a wise man once said, you know, when the weather's too bad to go to work, it's just about right to go duck hunting, and that's what you really like when if you're a duck hunter. But it was a nice day, and so the two of us decided to go down there, and my friend said, you know, there's the area that we normally hunt's a lot more open, or was at that time. He said, now there's one place back in the woods to the southwest of this swampy area. Said there's one place, there's a pond that's not very large, surrounded by trees, and the wood ducks come in there at night. So we might, you know, this time of year, we might, you know, get some shots, as sunset approaches. So we worked our way through the woods, and we set up there. We're both, you know, facing the south, and we're waiting for the, you know, for the birds to fly. Never did see any ducks that day. But what started taking place is started hearing some pistol shots. And somebody obviously just plinking or whatever. And so it's probably along the line of after about a dozen shots or so, then something struck me in the right side on the ballistic nylon holster that I carried a revolver in on my duck hunting trips. And substantial blow. So I hollered, "Quit shooting!" You know, and I hear this plaintive little voice off in the distance, you know, "Oh, okay!" You know, and thankfully, the person stopped. But the longer I waited, the more that impact started to sting. And so I thought about that. And I was talking to my friend. I said, "Why didn't you say something?" He said, "I couldn't." He said, "The bullets were going behind me. We were facing, if this were south, which it's not, but if this were south, the bullets were coming from my right going across behind me and hitting the tree that he was standing beside." Or he was around behind the tree. So he was safe. We looked at the tree. There were 6-8 impacts there from probably a 9mm, you know, handgun, you know, bullet. The reason that I wore a handgun is that just as a matter of safety, we would never load shotguns when we were handling decoys or setting up or anything. That's a really dangerous time. There's a lot of people moving around, so it's better, you know, for safety's sake, if you leave the shotguns unloaded and, you know, take care of your setup, and then when you're ready to hunt, then you load up. So because there were alligators and other critters down there, I thought, you know, I don't like walking around unarmed in that area. So, you know, I carried this revolver, and it was made, those of you that are enthusiasts would recognize the name of the, you know, the brand of the holster, but it's made out of ballistic nylon, which means that it's a substance that basically absorbs the energy of the impact of a bullet but doesn't permit the bullet to penetrate. But that bullet hit hard enough that it was several hours before the stinging subsided. And I thought about that in terms of the blessing involved in it. I thought, now, if that bullet or if one of those bullets would have hit me in the neck or the head, that was probably a fatal wound. So I thought, wow. You know, down here innocuously, you know, duck hunting, the last day of duck season, you know, the person that was plinking, you know, had no knowledge that we were there. They weren't doing anything unsafe other than they just weren't sure of their target, what was beyond it. And found out later they had put up, you know, a piece of metal in a fence, and they were just plinking at the metal, not knowing that the bullets were either going through it and on by, or that they were missing and the bullets were coming by where my friend and I were hunting. But I thought about that a lot. You know, I thought, wow, my life could have ended right there. My wife and daughter's lives would have certainly changed. And I was very grateful for that blessing that, you know, things could have turned out very differently. And that was one of those experiences that I can look back at and say, well, there's good news and bad news about the duck hunt. The bad news is I got shot. The good news is it didn't penetrate, you know. And that, but I was very thankful for that. I'd like to go now to a biblical example of both small and large blessings. And let's go back to the 19th chapter of the book of 1 Kings, and let's look at a little bit of the background of this, and then we'll read that 19th chapter of 1 Kings. This is about Elijah. And we see Elijah as a prophet of God, a man that was used in many mighty ways of God. And I want to just... If you look back across the page or two, you know, back into the 17th chapter of 1 Kings, we see a number of stupendous events that God used Elijah in and some of the blessings that were involved in that. You know, Elijah basically, you know, says, it's not going to rain, there's not going to be any dew except at my word for 3 years. And then that takes place, that sets in. You know, God tells him in the first part of that, well, I want you to go to this area where there's this little, this brook Cherith, as it's called. And God provided small blessings there in that Elijah was fed by ravens. He had meat and bread that was provided a couple of times a day, and he had water from the brook until the brook dried up. And so then, you know, there's the next section there that Elijah goes to location, and there's the widow and her son. There's a miraculous event that takes place where the last of that widow's foodstuffs last from then on. And, you know, their lives are spared, and Elijah continues to be fed, you know, by God's providence through that miracle and those blessings. And then something terribly unexpected happens, and the widow's son dies unexpectedly. And then Elijah is involved, and, you know, I'm kind of struck by that. In the 20th verse, Elijah says he cried out to the Lord and said, "O Lord, my God, have you brought tragedy on the widow with whom I lodge by killing her son?" I think, whoa, I don't know that I'd be comfortable, you know, making a statement like that to God. But Elijah was, and God's response to him was very patient. As James mentioned in the sermonette, it's not recorded that God said, "Who do you think you're talking to, Elijah?" But what was the Lord's response? He basically permitted Elijah to pray and to supplicate for that child's resurrection, which took place. A stupendous blessing. A stupendous blessing here that, you know, one of the resurrections that's recorded for us in the Bible. Then we get into the 18th chapter. There's the confrontation with Elijah and the prophets of Baal. But I want to read the 13th verse of chapter 18. And this is background to material that's going to take place, or that we'll read about in the 19th chapter. And there's a section here in the first part of 18 where there's some dialogue between Obadiah, who's sent out to look for water, you know, by the king, you know, for livestock, and then he encounters Elijah. And he's afraid that, you know, that when Elijah tells him that, you know, let Ahab know that, you know, I'm here, that Elijah's not going to show up and Ahab's going to kill Obadiah. But the 13th verse, you know, here is, I find really interesting. So what, Obadiah speaking, "Was it not reported to my Lord what I did when Jezebel killed the prophets of the Lord? How I hid 100 men of the Lord's prophets, 50 in a cave, and fed them with bread and water?" So prior to the events later in this chapter, where that there's the confrontation between, you know, the prophets of Baal and all that went on with that, and just Elijah by himself as the prophet of God, you know, Jezebel's already on record as having killed quite a number, and we're told to kill the prophets of the Lord. Now, Jezebel's solution to conflict resolution was kill them. You know, if that's basically the bottom line with her, she did not brook disagreement. And, you know, if something displeased her, she had no qualms, according to what's recorded for us, that she would have people killed. And in this case, she, and God permitted it, killed a number of the prophets of the Lord. So we have this tremendous confrontation. We have there the section where that Elijah takes the 12 stones, prepares an altar, digs a little trench around it that is designed to hold the water that he's going to have poured on there. A number of times he has water poured all over the offering, the altar, everything. There's water everywhere. And then he prays, and God miraculously vaporizes everything in sight. The rocks, the animal that was on that altar, or the meat that was on that altar, the water that was in the trench. But I think the thing that was most impressive to me is the rocks. I mean, they're gone. They're destroyed. You think, wow, what a tremendous example, what a tremendous event here. That it was very obvious to everybody that saw that, who was God? And that was the God that Elijah was praying to, not Baal. And then, you know, that all of the prophets of Baal are taken and they're executed. So Elijah has just gone through some stupendous blessings from God. You know, we go back and, you know, just to recap briefly, you know, he starts out, he prays, it doesn't rain, and it hasn't rained for 3 years. We go into, God provides for him at the brook Cherith. He goes to the city, and God provides to him and the widow and her son for a period of time. God resurrects the widow's son who dies unexpectedly. God miraculously shows, you know, that he is God when there's this confrontation with the prophets of Baal, and everything that altered, the stone, the animal, the water, is just vaporized, just gone. And then, you know, we come into the 19th chapter. 1 Kings 19, verse 1. Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done and how he had executed all of the prophets with the sword. What was Jezebel's response? Verse 2. Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, "So let the gods do to me and more also, if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time." Elijah, you're dead. That's what she's saying. I'm coming for you. Verse 3, and when he, that is Elijah, saw that, he arose and ran for his life. And he went to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and left his servant there. So Elijah, all of a sudden, has gone from being on an incredible high, seeing God's miraculous intervention for him in large and small blessings, time after time after time. Jezebel basically threatens him, and he melts. You know, and I think that one of the aspects of that, I think we focus, and I have tended to focus on, well, Elijah faltered at this point. But in reading, I want to see if I can find that verse. Should have written it down in my notes. Back to 18 and verse 1. The word of the Lord comes to Elijah, say, go present yourself to Ahab. I doubt if that was, you know, in most people's mind, a low-risk type of direction. You know, so, I mean, Elijah demonstrated, I think, a lot of courage at that point that, you know, God said that the word of the Lord came from it, told him to go see Ahab or present himself to Ahab, and he does so. And then there's the 19th chapter down to this point where, After the confrontation, then Jezebel basically threatens his life, and he just falters. You know, he's struggling at this point, but he has been a man that God has used mightily up to this point, and will do so later. Verse 3. Read that already. So he sees this and he takes off running. Verse 4. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came, sat down under a broom tree. Broom trees apparently are not like a cedar or a tall tree. They're lower to the ground type of a bush. And he prayed that he might die and said, "It's enough. Now, Lord, take my life, for I'm no better than my father's." And I think that is a uniquely human trait that I think probably most of us, if not all of us, can look back at different things that have happened to us in our lives, and sometimes you just think, you know, Lord, I've had it. You know, I don't know if I can keep doing this, or that I can, you know, survive this or that situation or trial or whatever. You know, and you just wish things would be over. And I think that was Elijah, in my opinion, that was his frame of mind. You know, I've just had it. I'm worn out. You know, she said she's going to kill me, and she's demonstrated that this isn't an idle threat. She's already killed a bunch of the prophets earlier. You know, but he's just saying, you know, Lord, take my life. You know, I'm done. I've had it. Verse 5, then as he lay and slept under a broom tree, suddenly an angel touched him and said, "Arise and eat." Now, how reassuring would that have been? You know, in your own mind, you're running for your life. Doesn't say a thing about any kind of provisions. Obviously, he had a need for some provisions, didn't have anything. You know, the angel says, "Arise and eat." The angel didn't say, "What are you doing out here, Elijah?" He wasn't remonstrated for his faltering. You know, he wasn't criticized by the angel, or certainly not by God to this point, as to, you know, Elijah, you need to man up here. You know, you're my prophet. You need to exhibit the fruits of faith. You know, there's nothing like that said here. And we think of the patience that God exhibited toward Elijah in this case. You know, sends this angel, and the angel deals with him very gently. Arise and eat. You know, verse 6. Then he looked, and there by his head was the cake baked on coals and a jar of water. So he ate and drank and lay down again. And verse 7. And the angel of the Lord came back the second time and touched him and said, arise and eat, because the journey is too great for you. You're going to be going on a long trip, Elijah. Verse 8. So he arose, ate and drank, and he went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights as far as Horeb, the mountain of God. And there he went into a cave and spent the night in that place. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he, that is God, said to him, what are you doing here, Elijah? What are you doing out here? What are you doing in this cave? Verse 10 is interesting. Does Elijah answer the question or not? Let's see. So he said, Elijah says, I've been very zealous for the Lord God of hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant. They've torn down your altars, killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left. It's just me, and they seek to take my life. Jezebel is after me. He didn't answer the question that God asked him. What are you doing out here, Elijah? And he's basically listing his problems and his frustrations. But he was not remonstrated by God at that point. There's no criticism recorded. There's no correction recorded here. So how did God deal with this? Verse 11. And then he, that is God, said, go out, stand on the mountain before the Lord, and behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind tore into the mountains and broke the rocks in pieces before the Lord. That was some kind of wind to be breaking rocks. But the Lord was not in the wind. After the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a still, small voice. And we see the power that God chose to demonstrate. It's just him and Elijah out there on Mount Horeb. Elijah's been in a cave. He's out there, at least where he can see what's going on, apparently. And God demonstrates some incredible power to his servant. Doesn't say anything at this point. So we have these three stupendous events that take place that Elijah can witness. You have to wonder, what was he thinking? What was going through Elijah's mind? You know, that's not recorded for us at this point. But the Lord was not in any of those, as it said. After the fire, a still, small voice. Verse 13. So it was when Elijah heard it that he wrapped his face in his mantle, went out, stood in the entrance of the cave. Suddenly a voice came to him saying, same question. What are you doing here, Elijah? Same question. What's Elijah's answer the second time? And he said, I've been very zealous for the Lord God of hosts, because the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they seek my life. Still didn't answer the question. He repeated the answer that he gave before, apparently. Verse 15. Then the Lord said to him, go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. And then he's given some instructions to anoint three people. When you arrive, anoint Hazael, king over Syria. And then in 16, you shall anoint Jehu, the son of Nimshi, as king over Israel, and Elisha, the son of Shaphat, of Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint as prophet in your place. Verse 17, it shall be that whoever escapes the sword of Hazael, Jehu will kill, and whoever escapes the sword of Jehu, Elisha will kill. And then there's the statement, a conclusion there. Yet I have reserved 7,000 in Israel, all whose knees have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him. So we see in this 19th chapter, you know, we see Elijah at an ebb in his life and in his experience. And we see some stupendous blessings there. We see the patience that God exhibited toward Elijah, and we see some very small blessings. You know, we see the providing of food by that angel on two different occasions to enable Elijah to make that, you know, that kind of a journey. And then, you know, it goes on, and we see in the chapters after this, we see some stupendous deliverance by God of Israel, to the place where, in one instance, there's 100,000 Syrian soldiers that are killed by a smaller, less capable army of Israel. And something that just mentioned in passing that said the remnant of the Syrian army fled into this city, and it said a wall fell on and killed 27,000 more. You think, wow, I mean, what size of wall would that have been, you know, to have that many people, you know, in proximity to it, to where that when the wall fell, and that had to be miraculous, I believe, that it killed 27,000 more Syrian soldiers. So we see in these passages, in this part of 1 Kings, you know, numerous examples, and even in Elijah's case, we see he's in the midst of a really serious trial in his life, some very difficult circumstances for him, and God is providing some small blessings along the way. He also provided some fantastic blessings along the way as well. So what's the significance of looking for small blessings? You know, we're told in the Gospel of, or in the book of 1 John in chapter 4, you know, verses 8 and 16, that God is love. He defines love, he personifies love, he is love. It's by his example and by his character and his conduct that we understand a little bit of what love is. And, you know, we see the tremendous blessings that are exhibited to us by the love of God. But I think by looking at and for some of the small blessings, we can more greatly appreciate the depth of love that God has for us, and the tenderness and the kindness that he chooses to exhibit to us at his will in our lives in very small and in many cases some very insignificant ways. You know, he can certainly do the magnificent blessings as he so chooses, but I think sometimes it's easy, if we're not careful, to overlook some of the little things that God does for us in our daily lives. So let's look for small blessings in our daily lives.